and welcome to The Wire, where you can get independent coverage of current affairs wherever you are around Australia. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on the program today...
But there is no funding that supports carers, because the NDIS doesn't fund carers. And when we changed the NDIS system, a lot of the services that were funded were defunded or had a big reduction in funding.
NDIS funding is not something that can easily be accessed by carers, who are often the forgotten people in the system. Many people sacrifice their whole lives for a loved one with little compensation for their efforts. Also on the program...
It wasn't that they didn't want to go see their dad. It's the fact that she was getting really emotional about it. And so they go where there's less pressure, and that's away from the dad.
After an emotional and sometimes acrimonious breakup, many couples consciously or unconsciously indoctrinate their children with their own transferred emotions. This can make it difficult for the child, and the ex-partner can become extremely embittered. Well, today is Parental Alienation Day, which highlights the problems experienced after family breakups. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire. But first, on Sunday at the Premier's press conference in New South Wales, Auslan interpreters were told to go home and that they would no longer be required. Up until now, all other important health and emergency press conferences had an Auslan interpreter in attendance. All other states and territories also use Auslan interpreters. Shirley Liu from Deaf Australia is deaf herself, and in this interview, an Auslan interpreter is interpreting for her. I asked Shirley whether she was surprised at the New South Wales government's move.
Unfortunately, not surprised. When we think about New South Wales announcements, if it's not related to COVID or health updates, we don't see interpreters. So in that situation on Sunday, that information wasn't accessible to the deaf community, which was really disappointing for the community. The community would like access, just like every other New South Wales person, to have access to the information, which is important from the Premier.
But the previous conferences that have been, press conferences that have been held, particularly with Gladys Berejiklian, they all had interpreters, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right. Most of the time we would see an Auslan interpreter with Gladys Berejiklian, along with the Minister of Health, and that's where key information was communicated to the community about COVID and how to manage COVID following the health orders, how to prevent getting COVID. So all that information had been accessible previously. I would say a small handful of press conferences with Gladys Berejiklian were not interpreted, and often that was because the location was moved at the last minute or there had been a miscommunication. Of recent times, we've seen a really steady bookings process where interpreters had been booked ahead and always been present.
Why is it so important for people with hearing disabilities to have this service? Why is Auslan so important to you?
Yeah, that's a really great question. A lot of deaf people, their primary language is not English. That's actually a secondary language. It could actually be a third or fourth language. So when we look at Auslan and look at English, the grammatical and linguistical structure is very different. So it's really key to have an interpreter there at press conferences to know that that information is actually accessible in a person's first language. That information is being interpreted and made accessible for people within the community. Within the spoken language, we see tone, we see affect, whether we can convey then if a conversation or announcement is serious or there's a bit of jest in there. We match that along with the body language and facial expressions to see how key is this information, how serious is this information. So a lot of people say, well, isn't there captions? Isn't that enough? Actually, it's really not, because, you know, with English, we've seen examples in the past where captions haven't been captured correctly. We did see that in the bushfires. There was a specific area that was spoken in English, but when it was relayed to captions, the wrong suburb was actually put into captions. So in order to make sure the information is not only accurate but accessible, we need a sign language interpreters.
And it's different in, say, England and America, isn't it? And we think, oh, well, they're English-speaking countries, so they probably would have the same sign language, but they don't, do they?
Yeah, that is the case. We see different sign languages. I would say approximately, I'd say over 200 sign languages across the world. We do see that over spoken languages as well. So we need to consider that both the same, that where there is a spoken language, there'll be a specific sign language as well.
And when you're using a sign language, it's very expressive, I notice. And then a lot of people sort of who aren't, don't have any hearing problems are actually watching the interpreter because it's interesting to see the expressions on their faces and the way they do things. And all interpreters are a little bit individual as well, aren't they? Do you have a favourite interpreter?
So in saying that, yes, Auslan is very much expressive language. It's a very visual language. It's something that people can identify with very quickly. It's very visual. Interpreters have different levels of skills and specialise in different areas. So some people specialise in legal or medical or family and social. I find that all deaf people would have their preferred interpreter for different areas of their life because understanding a person's articulation of sign language and being able to produce that in a way that another person understands, it's almost like having an accent. So each deaf person or each interpreter has an accent, and that can be based on where they've grown up, how they've learnt sign language, where they work, who they interact with. And we don't always get to choose our interpreter, but it's nice to have a selection.
And I suppose people are looking at news and the television might be on and they might glance at it and they might have the captions. But I would guess that if there was an interpreter there, you'd think, oh, there's some announcement, there's something important, I should watch it.
Yes, that is the case. We often see interpreters there at important announcements. But what we're trying to say is that any New South Wales announcement from government should have a sign language interpreter there. If that information is key or general information, to make that information not only accessible to people that can hear in the New South Wales public, but to people that are deaf. So when we're thinking about podcasts or interviews, we see barriers every day for deaf people, and that information is missing from deaf people's lives. So what we're trying to do is advocate to create a solution for the New South Wales government to become responsible for providing interpreters for all announcements.
Shirley Liu from Deaf Australia, using the services of an Auslan interpreter, speaking with me there. We approached a number of New South Wales departments to explain the change in press conference practice, but we received no explanation prior to going to air. I'm Roderick Chambers and you're listening to The Wire, around Australia on the Community Radio Network.
Whenever I want to catch up with current affairs in Australia, I head to thewire.org.au or I follow them on Twitter. I just search for The Wire Radio, all one word. And yes, they're on Facebook too.
There's been a call to extend state care in Victoria up until the age of 25. This follows a new report which showed that more than half of those leaving care ended up homeless after 4 years. The report found that compared with other young Victorians, state care leavers were 21 times more likely to access alcohol or drug treatment, 17.5 times more likely to use homeless services, and 4.5 times more likely to end up in the emergency department. Isabella Michie asked Dr. Robin Martin why state care needs to be extended.
Look, we're proposing 25 to try and even up the community expectations and standards. And the reason we're proposing that is there is this issue about all those factors I've mentioned about the level of kind of emotional, the level of attachment disruption, the potential trauma that this group has experienced. But also, the reason most young adults are staying at home beyond 21 is because the cost of housing is a cost and availability is a primary reason why those young adults are staying at home. So, you know, it gives them an opportunity to save and prepare and develop all that sort of readiness. So our question is, why would we think about those who've had an experience of care any differently to those that haven't? Should we, in fact, think about providing a more supportive journey for them towards adulthood, given their life circumstances?
Chair of the Home Stretch Campaign, an initiative aimed at extending the age of state care across Australia to 21, Paul McDonald agreed with the report's findings.
Yeah, well, look, a couple of things. Look, there's a lot of adolescent science in development says the brain doesn't stop developing till you're 25. And in fact, actually, you know, talking of figures, I think some 45% of 24, 25-year-olds is the average leaving home something along the 24-and-a-half-year age group for Australians. So, in fact, it's very common to continue to care to 25.
Despite the presence of national and jurisdictional standards which require that leaving care planning start at the age of 15, there is minimal or no monitoring of this practice. The report found this limited or non-existent planning for care leavers as a major concern, leaving young people often overwhelmed by the process.
That in fact, actually the system, being the state care system, usually notifies a young person that their order is about to expire or they're about to turn 18, either one, whichever comes first really in their 17th year, or for 40% in their 16th year, they'll send them a letter, maybe 3 months out, to say, well, look, thanks very much, but your time has now come to an end. So we've seen warnings, if I could put it like that, or pre-planning for these young people has been pretty spasmodic and ad hoc and wishful, I'd have to say. So that, you know, the state care system says, but we're doing these leaving care plans and we're trying to introduce them at 15 and, you know, we want to get them set up. Well, what we do know is that that's a lot of promise by a lot of adults, but really a young person experiences very, very little of that wishful thinking. And that's why we want to guarantee that a care system isn't about sort of a time when someone falls into homelessness and then seeks some help from the state, but it's just a continued, you know, arrangement of care. Just like what we do know is that 85% of Australia's 18 to 21-year-olds are still with one or both parents. And so why wouldn't the state replicate the same as what the good parent would?
Reforming this process and including the involvement of the young person is key to ensuring the safety and security for care leavers, found the report.
Look, we would say the first thing is there has to be adequate planning that's more than a few months before leaving care age. But most importantly, that planning needs to meaningfully involve the young person. So it's more than a ticker box of, oh, what do you think about? But it's actually spending the time and assisting that young person to have a voice, and a voice that is listened to, that really directs the plan for leaving care. So, you know, there's a sort of political consumer mantra, nothing about us without us. And that's what we would say should be applied in this case. And the young people said that to us as well. They were really clear that they knew what they needed. So we need to see those young people as experts. And then we would also say a universal, you know, raising the age of leaving care to 25.
Whilst McDonald agrees with the report's recommendations, he states policy reform in the Australian childcare and welfare context is a conservative environment, and extending the age of care to 21 is a good base level when tackling this issue.
Once we get New South Wales and Queensland and these up on board on 21 and the other states fully implementing 21 for all care types, then I think we're in a very good position to evaluate that and see, well, what's the next sort of story for government? What's the next reform? So I think we've never said that 25 shouldn't be actually, you know, an objective here for the correct raising. It's the journey you go on. And we're wanting to focus that at least we bring every state and territory to, you know, base camp two, if I can put it like that, being 21.
Chair of the Home Stretch, Paul McDonald, ending that report by Isabella Michie.
The Wire, independent news and current affairs for the last 15 years and still going strong.
In the wake of National Carers Week, new research shows that one in three Australians have taken the mantle of carer for a family member or friend. Although this is a common occurrence that can happen to anyone, many Aussies believe that carers are not being properly compensated. Developing Australian Communities, an organisation dedicated to supporting carers, believes that more needs to be done to make sure the sacrifice of these people don't go unnoticed or uncompensated. Jack Kelly has more.
Becoming a carer can be an overwhelming sacrifice. 30% of Australians are currently in a role of caring for a loved one, which has the ability to impact their health and personal lives. Thea Calzoni is one of these people who've had to give up their previous life in order to look after a son who has an intellectual disability.
It's really changed me from being a rather self-centred, happy-go-lucky individual to someone who felt probably more responsible for their child than people who just had a baby feel. But because my son still depends on me as an adult, he still depends on me for important aspects of his personal care, organisation of his schedule and support to connect with the community and just to do everyday activities, I still have that intense responsibility. But I also have to temper it because I'm a carer and of an adult. I have to temper my responsibility with a sense of respect for his adulthood and to understand that even though he needs me, needs a full-time carer to coordinate things for him, that he also has the right to make his own choices.
A recent survey showed that 85% of Aussies agree that carers are not being adequately compensated. River Knight, co-founder of Developing Australian Communities, explains how certain people are not eligible for NDIS funding.
And with NDIS, what we're seeing is the person themselves who has a disability or acquires the support gets funding, but there is no funding that supports carers because NDIS doesn't fund carers. And when we changed the NDIS system, a lot of the services that were funded were defunded or had a big reduction in funding. So services that support, for example, grandparents caring for grandchildren, we've got, you know, some of those services, I guess, that work with people that aren't in the child protection system that maybe if that relationship breaks down, don't have that level of funding. And that's what we're advocating for at the moment.
And how easy is it for carers to get the NDIS funding that they need?
What we're finding is that there's a very crisis-driven approach to supporting carers. So it usually waits until there's a massive crisis or that relationship breaks down, and then there tends to be a response from funding bodies. So we found that we want to try and focus funding and projects towards the front line of coordinating services for people who are in that informal role so that they can continue doing that, because once it breaks down, it costs probably 10 to 20 times a lot more.
Thea was fortunate that she had the supportive opportunities to raise her son as a carer, but acknowledges that others weren't so lucky.
I think I'm in a fortunate position. You know, I have a very supportive partner. I have a job which where I work 3 days a week, where I feel very fulfilled in my job. I'm able, and even during COVID, I've been able to work from home. So I have sufficient income, and Julian has a pension. And we also own our own home. So our position is that of maybe less than half carers who have those sort of material supports behind them. Yeah, I would think for people who are managing on really limited incomes, it's a challenge, a daily challenge. And there are so many unexpected expenses that come up when you're caring for a person with a disability.
Where there's the worry of how you're going to support a loved one under your care, there's also the worry of what that loved one will do once you're not around. Thea shares her alternatives to a solution.
The financial issue is one thing, but the community support is by far and above the most important. If your loved family member with a disability is in a community where there are people around them who will watch out for them and who understand them and like them as a person, they will be cared for. And this is one reason why we are moving into a co-housing apartment complex where we will be the only family there with a family member with an intellectual disability. But there will be other people there who are really interested in community living, will have some shared gardening and shared rooftop living, and people will be able to include Julian in activities like gardening and some maintenance work and in cooking in a shared kitchen. So he'll become a person that will be well known and respected by people who can look out for him after we pass on. Also, his sister's buying an apartment in the same complex, so she will also be there to keep an eye on him and help out with things for him, but not to the degree that she might have had to be otherwise, which would have been really just utterly responsible for him. And that's a big load to put on a sibling's shoulders, something that many siblings do have to carry for their families, and they do it really well, but it is hard.
Thea Calzone, carer and author of the memoir Dancing with the Maternal Bond, ending that report by Jack Kelly.
No matter where I am in the world, I check in on The Wire and find out what's making news in Australia.
The Wire. Wire, current affairs on air and online, wherever you are.
Today is Parental Alienation Awareness Day, with an interesting story behind it. Parental alienation is a situation in which one parent uses strategies, sometimes like a form of brainwashing, whether it's alienating or programming, to distance a child from the other parent. One mother's search for answers kept leading her offshore to American and UK studies, but she found that hardly anyone in Australia knew what parental alienation was, let alone help those affected by it. Samantha Gray has this report.
Founder of Inni Mini Miney Mo Foundation, Amanda Sillers, experienced parental alienation both as a mother and as a child. Now she has made it her personal mission to educate and connect with people who are experiencing parental alienation here in Australia. This inspired her to create Parental Alienation Awareness Day in October, Mental Health Month, to highlight this rarely spoken about issue. Amanda wants to prevent the emotional trauma experienced by targeted parents and kids through education around parental alienation.
Parental alienation is when a parent or even non-family member or other family members can influence the child into hating or fearing the other parent without legitimate justification. And they can do it by sort of denigration, which a lot of people are more familiar with. It can be done with non-verbal communications, like their emotional responses. And it can also be done through sort of manipulating the child. And so when they repeatedly make these comments, it's like that's how they sort of start conditioning them, indoctrinating them, by making these statements or suggestions all the time. I've actually had parents come to me through their Facebook page and say, I really appreciate the stuff that you share because I didn't realise I was actually alienating my children. They were not wanting to go see their dad anymore. And I said, could you give me a little bit more information on that? Like, what did you learn? And she said, well, I was getting too emotional and like I was wanting to check in on him all the time at the other parent's place. And she was sort of interfering in the contact when he would contact the kids. The kids could see her emotional response and they were reacting to her responses. It wasn't that they didn't want to go see their dad. It's the fact that she was getting really emotional about it. And so they go where there's least pressure and that's away from the dad.
Inni Mini Miney Mo's website has many tips and coping mechanisms for both parents and children. But this is some of Amanda's insight into how parental alienation is experienced as a child and how they can start the journey to recovery.
Well, often the kids aren't equipped with healthy boundaries. If a parent's talking about something and it's upsetting them, it's okay to say, this is making me unhappy talking about this, or, you know, can we change the subject and talk about something else? And often they're interrogated for information about the other parent and they give in and they tell the alienating parent what they want to hear, even if it means lying. They can lie about things that just didn't actually happen. So their world is full of guilt. And what they need to understand is it's not their fault. They didn't choose this. They didn't choose to be manipulated or to be turned against the parent. Naturally, they want to love both parents. So it's important that they do get support, reach out to someone that they can trust.
Suicide survivor and mental health advocate Shelby Rowe echoed Amanda's advice while stressing the importance of never giving up.
I'm sorry if the adults in your life don't respond in the way that you need to help you stay safe, but don't give up there. Go find someone else to talk to. Reach out to a friend. Call your national hotline. Use a crisis text line. Find someone else to tell, because someone will probably be able to listen and to help you get the help that you need. You're worth it.
For parents suffering from separation, Parents Beyond Breakup helps provide a community of shared experience and can support you through the hard times. CEO Gillian Hunt said that the majority of parents accessing their services are fathers, but they are also the ones not wanting to reach out in fear of being further alienated.
One of the barriers to entry for a dad to reach out to us is thinking that people will think he has a mental health problem. Whereas what we understand to be very clear is that the distress they're experiencing is completely related to the situation they find themselves in, causes massive emotional response and massive distress and massive trauma, a whole host of other things that come with relationship and family breakdown. If you go and have a look at the federal government's budget that was announced in July this year, with the unprecedented amount of money that has been put towards suicide prevention nationwide, there is nothing allocated specifically for men, who are our highest demographic for suicide. That is the one thing that we will continue to advocate for, is additional funding specifically for men.
If you or anyone you know have been affected by this report, we ask you to please call your national crisis line. For Parents Beyond Breakup, call 1300 853 437. Or for Lifeline Kids, call 1800 55 1800.
That was Samantha Gray there with that story. And that's it for us from The Wire today. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 in Sydney and broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network. Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well and thanks for your company.
This must be the place for music.
Music? Yes, it's very good. Very good for the digestion.
Because when you subscribe to 2SER for Radiothon 2021, you can go into the draw for the Music Lovers Prize Pack. It's got an Audio-Technica turntable, record vouchers from Egg Records, Repress Records and The Vintage Record, record and merch packs from Piaz and Remote Control Records, a tour of the Atomic Beer Project Brewery for you and nine besties, and a case of Atomic Beer to boot. Subscribe and choose your prize pack now at 2ser.com.
Gante muso mangante galoti galau ma. Gante muso mangante binafigi muso ma. Gante muso mangante che nani muso ma. Gante muso mangante che bugo muso ma.